I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Nicole Lockwood. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, here we are in the west end of Fremantle on a beautiful sunny morning. Great place, Fremantle.
It is. It's been a part of my life since I was very young, so I feel very happy here.
So how young is it, was it?
Well, I grew up in Bicton, so as a sort of 8, 9, 10 year old, and then went to Santa Maria. So kind of that whole teen period was in and out of Freo, and then went to Notre Dame. So it was very much part of my formative years.
You can't be much more Fremantle than that. And you now live within Fremantle's boundaries. And you're doing all sorts of things, including things in relation to Fremantle.
Mm.
Tell us a little bit about what you're actively engaged in at the moment.
Mm. So the main project that I do in my consulting profession is for the Future Fremantle Project. So I'm the strategic advisor to the Minister for Planning and work with the project team at the Department of Planning on that project. And it's a really lovely segue from the work I did on Westport. So it's really looking at what's the possible future for this amazing footprint of land as the port starts to transition down to Kwinana.
Well, you always seem to me, Nicole, to be so calm and have everything well organised. And I suspect both those things are true, but then I look at everything you've been involved in, are involved in, you make me feel exhausted. I'm looking here. You're the chair of Infrastructure WA.
I am.
You're the chair of a group called Melka Foundation, and I think a venture capital group, Airbridge.
Mm-hmm.
You're the deputy chair of the Green Building Council of Australia. That's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're a member of the boards of NBN and the Child and Adolescent Health Service.
Mm.
How do you fit it all in?
Well, when I was at Westport, I was the chair of the Freight and Logistics Council at the time, I thought, what experience do I really have in logistics? And I decided it was probably more my life was my experience in logistics. It really is a planning exercise, and it takes time when you have a portfolio career to find the balance of roles that really mesh well together. And this is probably my third iteration of my board life. So it's exciting to get to a point where I really feel like I've been able to focus on and choose the roles that I really want to be part of.
Well, you also have a Bachelor of Laws and a Bachelor of Business in Environment from Notre Dame. You've mentioned them. And you're a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, which I imagine is really almost a basic set of requirements to have all of these portfolios. Has the law been helpful?
Oh, very much so. So I only practiced for about 7 years, but I think everything I learnt as part of my legal training has positioned me for what I do now. Law is one of those wonderful degrees that people think because you've got a law degree that you're smart. Whether or not you are, it doesn't really matter, which is a little bit helpful. But I think it's all about being able to understand multiple sides of a situation, being able to position a point of view. I find myself very much in a brokering role in a lot of what I do, so it tends to lean towards a lot of those skills.
Well, I also like the fact that you set out in your bio that you're passionate for sustainability and resilience building and the creation of thriving cities and communities equipped to embrace the challenges and opportunities of climate change and digital disruption.
Mm-hmm.
You're the age where you've really seen all of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But where did that passion come from initially? Mm-hmm. Did you get taught it at Santa?
Well, I was the kid in year 8 that was writing petitions about environmental damage, and I started an environmental movement at school where we were creating the bags you use at Coles. We were creating them, screen printing them and selling them to make money for our campaign work. So I remember doing a project in year 5 about CFCs, and it really worried me, this hole in the ozone layer, and that sort of really kicked off my interest. And so when I went to law school, I initially thought I was going to become an environmental scientist. That was sort of what I was thinking I'd do. And then I realised that didn't think I could have a lot of influence being a scientist, so maybe I'd be an environmental lawyer and then I could get somewhere. And just because of life circumstances, my law career started there but very quickly moved into other areas because of opportunities. So it's like I've been able to come back full circle to where I wanted to be, but I've learnt a lot on the way.
Well, we hear about infrastructure. Sometimes not quite sure what the word really means, at least not in the context in which it's used. Tell us, our listeners, a little bit about Infrastructure WA. It's no doubt connected with Infrastructure Australia and your current involvement.
Yeah, so I was on the board of Infrastructure Australia about 2 years after it started, so from 2008, for almost 10 years, and very frustrated through that period that we didn't have an equivalent in this state. So we had a lot of big projects happening, a lot of big visions, but no connection of those ideas together. So I spent a lot of time during that period trying to advocate for an equivalent, and obviously changing government a while back had a similar view, and I was very pleased to see it established. And when John Langelant was appointed as the chair, he approached me and asked if I would be interested in being his deputy. I think the benefit of having been on the IA board for so long and seeing it nationally, and I was obviously very involved in big state infrastructure programs as well. So it's been an amazing journey. We've got very powerful legislation in WA that actually binds the system to this planning cycle, which is quite unique. And we've got a government at the moment that actually believes in the idea of long-term planning. So it's quite a rare opportunity.
It's probably a good segue to Westport at this point. Long-term planning. But that's a huge long-term plan. A lot of people weren't happy to hear that the port as we know it, just over the road there in Fremantle, might be migrating, or is now migrating, south, Kwinana Way, Westport. What's the time frame on that, and when do you think it'll take place?
So that's the work that's being done right now to finalise the business case that talks to the transition plan. When we put our recommendations to government, our timing was around the early 2030s was when we anticipated it would be required, but then COVID hit. So a few things have changed since then. But as we saw, global shipping has had some interesting transitions through COVID. It obviously got shut down almost, but then really went quite, growth really hit it. So I think reforecasting that's happening at the moment. The big issue that we found with Fremantle was not so much about the port itself, it was always about the connections in and out of the port. And the difficulty we will have, no matter how buoyant the shipping market is that the gentrification of the Fremantle region and the densification of the surrounds mean that basically we're going to choke the network that allows for the movement of the goods. So my sense is, 2030s somewhere will probably be a point at which there needs to be some form of shift, and it will be really impacted by some of those other global factors which are a little bit hard to predict.
Tell us, again, it's at this point in reasonably general terms, but how would a west port around Kwinana operate? What would go there in terms of shipping, and what would happen to the stuff it brings into the state?
So the opportunity to design and build a greenfields port is fairly unique around the world. But thinking about the opportunities to use technology differently, the way we see the port operating here could be quite different down in Kwinana, because you can basically allow technology to drive the whole process. And the cost in supply chains is in the handling of goods. So the more you can take out movement and steps of double handling, the cheaper it gets. So the design of this port, being able to bring a ship alongside, have a crane remove a box, put it straight on some form of movement, whether it's automated trucking or if it's some form of rail link, and straight to either a depot or a destination, could make it far more efficient than what we have. Now, we did the work primarily on containers. That was the task we were given. But as everybody knows, there's a number of other trades here. But when you look at the value of those trades and the volume of those trades, they're very small. So it's now a task of looking at how they are complementing or not the container task, and what other locations could be servicing those.
The other locations, Western Australia, compared to many other parts of the country, has fewer major regional centres, but coming down from the top, we've got Broome, Port Hedland, Karratha, Carnarvon, Geraldton. Then we've got Fremantle in its various guises, Bunbury and Albany. That's probably pretty much it. Would you see the distribution of goods to those other places from Perth, or I suppose the northwest ports take their own loads.
So one of the opportunities that we identified at the time was trying to distribute some of these goods. And when you look at where they're coming from and going to, it was thinking, well, is the metropolitan port the best place to handle some of these goods? Now, ideally, particularly some of the large loads that come into Fremantle and go to the northwest, you really want them to come straight in out of the northwest. And during the time we were doing Westport, some pilots started, and now they are actually really gained some traction. So there's now direct shipping services coming in and out of Dampier and Port Hedland. So that takes a task out of the road network, basically, from Perth to the north, which is fantastic. Then the opportunity to look at other destinations. So we did look at Geraldton and Bunbury for containers. The issue is that basically the cost is in the length of the supply chain. So if you think about the majority of the population, so everything that's in a box pretty much is going to a person, you want them to be as close as possible to people. Unless we come up with another mode of movement that's very, very quick, efficient and cheap, you really can't break that model. So it gets more and more difficult to move tasks out of the core, and because we are so dense in one corner of the state, it does mean you've really got to get quite efficient at running that network with a lot of capacity in one spot rather than being able to separate it. We did have a look at the states because we thought, you know, from a rail perspective, you look at America, they've got a lot of different centres doing different things and they're all linked, but we just don't have the population in enough places to make the economics work.
Well, Westport will keep happening. And it in so many ways, of course, is connected to what's then happening right here in Fremantle in the port. When the port goes, what do you imagine would be left happening by way of shipping services here in Fremantle?
So with the task of containers being the main focus, then really you've got the other trades of obviously the Ro-Ro and the cars, the livestock and some of the break bulk type of goods. And that's all being analysed at the moment. So, you know, there's a question around timing of transition and what goes when and what goes first. What we're keen to look at the moment is how we can, in an orderly way, gradually redevelop BitKey. And if, you know, if over time we could move from the southern end and gradually move our way along, that would be ideal. But the work being done behind that is still underway, so we can't yet predict that. So the planning we're doing across the whole site will have options around staging, but ultimately we will build a plan that's for the whole site to be freight free.
So cruise ships would continue to come in here most likely?
They would, yep.
You'll get the visiting Indian warship doing a courtesy visit and flying the flag. You'll get research vessels that might come in. You'll get Greenpeace coming by, as they are at the moment. So there'll be a lot of activity in the port, it just won't be container activity.
That's right.
And I guess some of the iconic impressions people have, or memories they have of Fremantle, at least over the period the big cranes have been in, the giraffes over on North Keep, they'll be packed up presumably and taken, or be a different vista.
But there's an opportunity in the redesign to think about what elements people want to see retained. So those landmarks could be reimagined for different purposes. That doesn't mean we have to lose the fabric of what everybody loves.
Well, it made me start to think of an interesting residential building that looks like a giraffe.
That's right.
Just need to go to Beijing and Shanghai to see some of the imaginative buildings that have been produced.
Well, I suggested to the team perhaps it could be a restaurant where you sit in a container and it goes up and down while you have your dinner.
Be careful what you wish for, Nicole.
Right.
The question of what happens, not just on Victoria Quay and not just immediately on the North Quay side, but from there and going north, particularly up to Leighton, there's currently out for comment for another month or so. A proposed amendment to the Metropolitan Region Scheme so that the land between the Leighton Apartments and Tideman Street, which for people who aren't immediately thinking about it, borders on the North Quay area, would be rezoned urban deferred. One assumes it's pretty much a fait accompli. Urban deferred means you've got it there and you can sit down and start to think about how it's going to be replanned, what sort of development you're going to get. What's the process by which that imagining will happen.
Mm. So the process for the substantive sites of the Victoria Quay, North Quay land is being, basically has just kicked off. So we've started with a very involved engagement process with the Aboriginal elders first. We thought it was really important that this is a site of cultural significance and a site of quite extreme trauma and grief. And if we're going to be genuine about reconciliation, this is an amazing opportunity to try and resolve some of that. So that's where we've started, and we're now starting to build into the community conversations about understanding the context, and then we will move to visioning. So that really sort of sets the framework for the centre. What's important about what sits north of that is the access and the connections. And again, you don't want to do these things in pieces because otherwise you don't get the overall benefit. We know that the road and rail connections coming into Fremantle have been fraught for many years, and North Fremantle have been in conversations with us at my time at Westport, and now certainly in this project, desperate to reunite that town centre and find a way to heal some of the division that happened when the port was growing in the early days. So the site that's out for amendment at the moment is a critical part of that puzzle, as are some of the new developments further north, as well as the marshalling yards along the rail line. But in the mix of that, we've got a very active conversation about inundation, about how we manage the beaches along that section. So we really need to take this chance to look at the whole at once and get it right, so that then everybody gets the benefit of that planning.
It's about 2 years ago now when all of this started to pick up, mm-hmm. and there was a tender to get some imaginative people to produce a land use plan. What's happened on that side?
So in terms of our project, obviously everything takes a little while to get moving. North of that, I think there's just been so many different interests that have sort of come to the fore. And as we know with development, it's very much dependent on the market. So these plans that are done can be relevant for a moment, and then something new comes in, or there's a new opportunity and they potentially don't stick. So it is about us, I think, getting a collective vision that the community is comfortable with, and you've got political and state government agency buy-in to, so that then you can gradually build it out. And that's something I learned from my time in Karratha. You know, you really do need to have that long-term plan to get traction.
There are a whole range of questions that the people, the Department of Planning, were putting out to the people tendering for the job to be imaginative, but it included things like, what's the future of work? What do you see as being the future of work? Have you started to get your head around that?
Well, that's exactly at the heart of the conversation we're having right now. So the centrepiece of this work is an economic development strategy. The question we first want to answer is, what jobs are going to replace the jobs that are moving from this port site? The exciting part and the timing of this work is that we're probably the first site in the world that will rethink an urban city hub post-COVID and learn the lessons of what happens when you have a disruption of that scale. So it really has to be about that really integrated planning, land use, transport, economics. How can you create a place where everything you need is right there? It's almost going right back to the way planning was done, you know, 150, 200 years ago, in little town centre style environments where you had a walkable catchment, and it was about connection and community. And that's really what we're hoping to achieve through this planning exercise.
I wrote an article on the Shipping News 2 years ago, starting to imagine what might happen, making the point, I don't think with too much hyperbole, it's probably the biggest planning exercise since John Septimus Roe produced the Fremantle Plan in 1833, and mm-hmm. probably the biggest infrastructure works in CY O'Connor did the Inner Harbour mm-hmm. right here. It really is huge. Mm-hmm. People are worried about, in ordinary parlance, about what sort of mix of development mm-hmm. you might get there, and how big it's going to be, just how dense it's likely mm-hmm. to be. What do you imagine it might be like? Are there precedents for it? Do we need to go to Cupertino or somewhere? Should we go to some development in Spain? Is there anything there to tell us the way forward?
What's been interesting in doing the analysis, so that the consultant team has been looking globally at case studies, and what we first realised is that this site is bigger than almost every other port redevelopment site in the world. So it's quite unique in terms of scale. What we've also learnt, though, is that no other site is replicable in terms of lessons learned. So you want to take the best of a range of different examples. In terms of what will it look like, well, that's exactly the exercise we're about to embark on that we want the community to help inform. And it will be about a series of scenarios. And what we're keen to do is to push the limits on those scenarios to show people what that means. So if you think about it potentially from a green environmental sustainability point of view, and that becomes your focus, what would life look like? If you think about it from an economic jobs perspective, and you want a hybrid of them all, but we really want to paint the picture of those different ways of living and the trade-offs that come with them. I was in Japan in October last year for a global infrastructure summit, and we did a field trip to a urban redevelopment site, and they've got towers in there that are about 40 stories. There's only about three of them, and in amongst that are these amazing gardens, and it's a wellness focused location. So you can find ways to get both. It's not about a Gold Coast style development. It's more about how can we make the commercials work, but get the quality of the amenity right, and then create hubs for activity and that type of thing. Now, I'm not sure height like that would ever be acceptable, but density of some sort, even if it's five or seven stories, may be what's required to get the sort of activation you want from a site like that.
One of the really big challenges, and I've seen it, and certainly people in North Fremantle and probably Fremantle more generally, is the question of how you connect these things together in terms of transport. Mm. If you did have some very large towers, that means lots of people in the area. It begs the question whether they'll all have at least one car per living unit. What about trains? What about fast urban transport? Where will the roads and the bridges go? Will there be new bridges, do you imagine? Yeah.
So there's a couple of factors that are going to play heavily into this work. The first is there's some national research going on at the moment around the path to net zero in transport. And we're having equivalents done here for WA. But basically what it's showing is that we need to reduce. So as at today's population numbers, even if we fully electrify everything, we still need to reduce our private movement, basically, in cars and other forms, and in freight. So that means that's not accounting for growth in population, and that's not accounting for, I suppose, people's expectations. So the benefit of a site like this is, because you're not asking people to change behaviour that already live there, you can create something that's very much not what we've seen before. And in my mind, personally, I think this probably needs to be a place where there are no cars. Where you create, as you say, the other options around mobility as a service or public transport linkages that provide that connection, but you do not clog the site with cars. And I think if people are given the option to buy in, they either choose to be in that environment or they don't, I think that's a legitimate outcome. But the work we've already started doing around the density of the site, and it's on a peninsula, so you're basically gridlocked in terms of getting in and out. It will break the site if we have much level of use at all, let alone the linkages through the rest of Fremantle that are already very constrained.
We've both mentioned the North Fremantle setup and how they've been impacted over time, the construction particularly of the Stirling Bridge and occasional discussion that there might be more lanes added and that sort of thing. And just to drive through there, make you realise that it's been significantly severed North Fremantle. You've got Queen Victoria Street, you've got the nice little coffee shops, you've got the famous Mojo's, really good wine and liquor store. But when you go further west, it quickly runs up against a railway line, and then getting into Leighton and Port Beach, down Tideman Road is a challenge. You've got Curtin Avenue coming from Cottesloe for much of the way, right next to, parallel to the Perth-Fremantle railway line, and then it does all sorts of doglegs. Mm-hmm. Are there some obvious and ideal road solutions that connect this new area with North Fremantle and with Fremantle?
Mm. Well, what we're going to do is put it all on the table. There's been lots of plans done over many years, none of which have ever been accepted or committed from a government to the point of construction, many of which probably need some rethinking, not just because of the reuse of the site, but also because of social perception of the way roads interact with our environment. So what I would say is, again, those elements will be up for grabs. That's a debate point for the community. And I think we want to find a solution that's actually about creating connection, not about creating car passages.
Not creating roads for the fun of it.
That's right.
Well, Main Roads might want to hear that message. They're very good at building roads. Do you think, just coming to things like bridges, the bridge debate in Fremantle has been really interesting. Mm. We probably first met when Fremantle Shipping News got a bit irate about the proposal to knock over the old traffic bridge and build a new one. Mm-hmm. Having been a lover of Manhattan and the High Line, I'd written an article very early on in Shipping News about 5 or 6 years ago that we should think about creating a High Line. But is there any news on what's happening? It seems to have gone to sleep, the rebuild and the knocking down.
Yeah. Look, there's definitely a lot of work going on behind the scenes. I think there's a lot of complexity in that site. So, you know, not the alignment, the restriction of the footprint that you can launch and land on, obviously community sentiment, and then the complexity of the market and budget at the moment is making every project problematic. Compounded by the fact that, you know, the workshops that I was involved in a few years back, it was very much about wanting to make sense of that project in the context of the broader. And what we're about to do now is hopefully bring the rest of the story to life so that we can understand how the bridge functions relative to both sides of the river. So I think the fact that it's been delayed, whilst frustrating for everyone involved and probably for the community, in some ways is a good thing, because we get the opportunity to just double check that we're comfortable that what's going ahead is going to connect well. And then, as you said earlier, there's a conversation to be had about other connections, because the reality of the site is it's quite significant distance to get from North Quay to Victoria Quay. And the reality is you want some way to be able to get from one side to the other. So that's, again, part of the opportunity for visioning.
Well, I can remember not long ago somebody crazily suggested having a gondola going from King's Park down to Elizabeth Quay. I won't be surprised if someone suggests the same thing from North Quay to Victoria Quay. Has it happened yet?
Oh, look, we've had some school students involved over the last couple of years coming up with suggestions, and some of their concepts have been amazing. So, and we had a workshop a couple of weeks back with some young people and some uni students. So the exciting thing about this is it really is up for the imagination. And over time, you know, who knows what could be put in place.
When it comes to the railway, I mean, there are so many challenges in trying to replan this port area, the two bridges, the railway bridge, the fact that there will continue to be a big use of the port, even by ships like Queen Mary II, the two was in here recently,
yep.
Huge vessel, and you know, she turns around in that space and she's pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have too many other bridges through there.
So that's one of the things we sort of contemplated early on, and whether a relocation of the passenger terminal to closer to the mouth would be an option. So that's another thing we'll put in the mix, because all these options, you know, we've started talking about, again, we'll discuss with the community of bridges that hinge and cantilever, costs all associated with those sorts of things, but that is a big constraint in terms of being able to create a connection across the centre.
Yeah, as a Fremantle person, making sure things happen right for Fremantle is important for those who live here, but it's such an amazing place, Fremantle. We have to get it right for the people of the whole state.
It's so true, and I think from an engagement perspective, it's something we're really mindful of, that, you know, my comment to the team is every person in the state at a barbecue would have a view on what they think should happen on this site. So we have to give every one of them the opportunity in some form to be able to participate. Now, the great thing about the virtual environment is we're getting better and better at doing that. So we will do our best to allow, to a certain extent, it to be visible outside of Fremantle. But I think that's such an important point for the people of Fremantle to remember that, that this site is actually for an audience, an international audience. And so we've got to balance off the heart and soul and the fabric of the place and what the local residents want against the opportunity that we can offer as a destination for this state.
It is amazing. There are so many people who probably don't come to Fremantle all that often, but they have passionate and strong views.
Very much so.
They don't always agree with the passionate and strong views of the Fremantle people.
No, that's for sure.
Another area that people are desperate to see developed in or around Fremantle is sort of a bigger cultural centre. Mm. Music places, theatre places. Mm. Is that part of the thinking?
Very much so. I think in the first year or so I was involved in the project and we were sort of getting formed, had lots of conversations across the Fremantle community, and arts, culture, performance was such a strong theme. Obviously a lot of conversation about the current venues that are available and their positives and negatives. If you think about North Quay as a destination, you want an iconic landmark to bring people there, and you know, we've talked about, you know, the idea of an opera house or something, you know, equivalent, that is a space that is a draw card that can be used by multiple groups, that isn't about competing with the city. It's about creating a point of difference. And I think that's, again, some of the opportunity that we can debate through the visioning. We are already talking to a number of performance groups about what their needs are, so we understand that for the visioning exercise.
Well, if you go to the Lincoln Centre on Manhattan, you get off the subway, you walk up and you more or less walk in. Mm. It comes back to that transport issue, doesn't it? You can't have people all heading off to such a major cultural centre and trying to drive their cars into
it. That's right. When you look at the stadium as an example, and everyone sort of scoffed at the idea of having no access private transport-wise, but you know, I stupidly tried to drop my husband there on the weekend and realised I'm never doing it again. It is definitely a public transport only zone, and when you do that, it's actually a very comfortable, relaxing exercise. So, well planned, it's a fantastic outcome, and that's how cities all around the world work. You know, Perth is still a little bit immature in that way, and it's something we've got to sort of keep encouraging people to understand.
Well, the MCG is another very good example of how that works. One of the things that sort of bothered us, probably the commercial operators in Fremantle, is that suddenly there might be this competing commercial heart. Mm. You know, new shop fronts, new people selling my muesli, and I'll go there instead of into the heart of Fremantle. How do you see that working out, or is that just going to be a fact of life?
Mm. It's such an important consideration. The benefit of this being a long-term plan, we've got a minimum of a decade before anything of substance will happen. The opportunity now is to make sure that Fremantle is growing and building on what it has, so that by the time that site is available, it becomes an extension of Fremantle rather than a cannibalisation of Fremantle. So we're working very closely with the council. They're obviously out doing their strategic community plan work at the moment, and we'll be interested to see what comes of that. What we're keen to do is, where there's new opportunities that don't currently exist, is to incubate them and test them in the next decade in facilities we already have, so that the redevelopment becomes a growth opportunity rather than we're going to try and start things from scratch with a brand new building. I think you've got to build the ecosystem of support and, you know, the different operators, and they've got to want to be here to make it successful. So we've got that chance with, you know, still empty space in Freo itself. We've got the Victoria Quay element, which we're starting to turn our minds to in terms of activating those spaces. But I think the council is very, very aware, and certainly the mayor talks often about Fremantle needing to be bursting at the seams by the time this happens, so that it's a successful transition.
A lot of people are concerned that there might be bursting at the seams in the new redeveloped area, the other side of Tidyman Street, that pushes right into Port Beach area. There's we've got the beach, we see it being re-nourished regularly. It seems like that's just a process we have to get used to happening each year or most years. Will there need to be, or will it necessarily happen? There'll be reclamation or putting land into public trust over there?
So there's an opportunity in rethinking the site to look at different solutions to that problem. So So one thing that we're really aware of is this is going to be a location where that will be a beach for those people that live there. So thinking about, is there an opportunity to create more beach, and the way it's built, could we create a different movement pattern that allows for less impact? Or do we have to move to a method of retreat, and then we look at parkland and other things? So a lot of work has already been done on that because of the renourishment project. So we're taking that work and taking another step and looking at the site itself as a lever to potentially create an additional solution to the problem and potentially create some new amenity that's not there. How can we, you know, the idea of ocean pools and different things that are not there that could be part of a solution?
The word shark suddenly enters into mind. There's that whole question that, going back to the young Nicole Lockwood wanting to save the environment at primary school. I mean, we've got climate change, we've got sea levels rising, new data out recently in the scientific community about the temperature rises in the oceans. We're seeing all the erosion that's happening around there. The shipping news has posted all the photographs just about after every storm. Mm. Will there have to be a boundary for development brought in a long way?
Mm. Well, I think that's the question where we need to answer from a structural perspective, is where's the site sitting at the moment? Do we need to change the configuration of the site? Do we need to lift the site? Or do we build to accommodate for that impact? And that's a choice at this point. There's a cost impact for that, but it's something that we have the ability to consider as a trade-off.
Well, when do you think, from a public point of view, mm-hmm. The public will be shown something, which will then have them saying, oh, that looks interesting, or why haven't you got something else there, and why isn't that boundary drawn further back here? What sort of process are we looking at?
Yeah, so at the moment we're having some targeted focus group sessions on specific aspects, which have already kicked off. We're then producing a document that really frames the opportunities and constraints of the site, and that will be published close to the middle of the year for full community review. So that's our starting point, right? Here's the site, here's what we're working with, here's the things we have to consider. Then we go into visioning. So second half of the year, basically, we start to look at sessions, pop-in sessions, drop-ins, and then some fairly large planning charrette-style exercises where, again, we can't have the whole community involved, but we'll have a large audience, and we'll look for ways to broaden that out virtually, where we start to design up these three options, so these three scenarios, and then they're tested, and then they come back to the community for consultation, and then we'll refine that back to one next year, and then that will be tested again, and then we'll take that through to a final recommendation towards the end of next calendar year.
The future for Fremantle area, when you look at it on the map, of course, takes in Victoria Quay, that mm-hmm. is the southern side of the inner harbour, as well as going over it, mm-hmm. And it takes all Rouse Head in, and it goes all the way down to Leighton and across to the railway line.
That's right.
And so what you're just talking about, it'll encompass all of that?
The whole site.
So we'll start to see how a specific development plan that might be coming forward for Leighton to Tideman ties in with a much bigger picture.
That's right. And the opportunity of that site, given that it's already deconstrained, there's already an opportunity to think about that, could be an early development site. So if you think about what's going on at the port at the moment, there's going to be a significant period of time for those uses to transition and then for remediation works to be done. It's not going to happen overnight. And obviously there'll be thought about staging that. But that latent site becomes your first opportunity to really start. So you've got Victoria Quay in that site, which means you could then have a program that sort of sequentially starts to move its way around, which is exciting from a delivery perspective. I think whatever comes out of the process that's going on at the moment is almost a baseline. It's, yes, we could use this site for other uses other than freight, and here's an example. But the opportunities that our visioning exercise will bring will be far in excess of anything that's currently contemplated because the parameters have changed entirely from what the site was initially part of.
It's amazing, isn't it? Do you sort of think people are going to be surprised at what they're, in a sense, offered?
I hope so. I think one of the risks of any project at the moment, but particularly one in Fremantle, is the level of cynicism and distrust that the community has in government processes. So what we're hoping with this exercise is that we run an exercise that is very much a blue sky, opportunistic analysis. And you know, yes, it'll always be subject to a cost at the end, but this is everyone's chance to really have their say. So, and I think, you know, during Westport, you know, I could feel, and personally I had concerns and views around the changing nature of Fremantle as a destination and what moving the port would mean. But I think what this offers is something that's far more exciting for the community. You know, if the community's love of the port was watching something happen on the other side, this is the community basically being given access to an amazing location that could have all sorts of benefits for them that they would never have had otherwise.
We're close to finishing this interesting discussion, Nicole. The other things you do, tell us a little bit about them, and you must get a lot of a thrill out of the other endeavours you're involved in.
Yeah, I do. I think my portfolio sort of now falls in two camps. One half is really around infrastructure and net zero and the transition of that journey. And the other half is now around entrepreneurship and innovation and education. And what's exciting about the Freo project is I'm getting to do both in one location. So it's really bringing together how you use infrastructure as an enabler to then get outcomes. And for me, infrastructure is always about the outcomes for people. We only build things because it's for our needs. So if we don't remember that, it becomes an end in itself, which is no good to anybody. But the entrepreneurial side is exciting to me because all of the challenges we face need totally different solutions. And they need a level of creativity and courage that potentially we haven't seen as much of recently as we potentially did, you know, early in Western Australia's history. So very involved in climate-related technologies, looking at how we build an education system that's about encouraging more young kids to think about starting their own business as an opportunity, and using, I suppose, both the technology and the environment side as a driver for that. So it's I'm involved with a lot of amazing, brilliant people that just can see something and make it happen, which I love. And then can help them knit that into the fabric of government and how we get things done in the system that we have.
The debate in Western Australia in particular, the country as a whole, about having downstream processing, whatever it might be, we shouldn't be sending our iron ore somewhere else to be made into things, we should be at least processing some of it here. Too many people head off with their skills to other parts of the world. It's all on again at the moment. We produce lithium in this country. Are we turning it into batteries? Are there proposals to do that?
There certainly are. Numerous companies here are contemplating it. I think there was an announcement last week by the federal government that they want to see that as an outcome for this country. You know, this dig it up, ship it out mentality that we've had, we've been able to be fairly rudimentary in our approach because we've had plenty of it and the economics have been right. But the climate change debate has flipped that on its head. And we've still got all the ingredients, but we just have to be smarter about how we use them. And I think we've got the capability. Potentially our regulatory environment is still not moving fast enough to catch up with what this industry needs. But I think government, you know, obviously is hearing the messages strongly, is making its own steps around net reductions, which is very impressive globally when you look at legislating targets and making interim steps from the state's perspective at an early stage, at the 2030 mark, that's quite unique. So I think we really are getting on the right path, but this is a massive system that we've been locked into for probably the last 70 years that served us brilliantly. In an environment now where that level of vision and political will is no longer socially acceptable, so that the will it took to establish the iron ore industry and the oil and gas industry and the political license that they had at the time doesn't exist now. So we're in a bit of a fraught position, and every opportunity that we need to pursue now does not sit within government or industry or community alone, it's a collaboration. And that's the most complex type of project. So that's why I love what I do, because my probably private title is Chief Cat Herder. And it's all about finding the common connection between groups. Where is the win-win? Or where is the mutual compromise where we can move forward? because inertia has become our you know, sort of MO for a long time.
And then you've got these, what it would appear to me to be social commitments, organisations that you're involved in. And tell us a little bit about that.
So the Child and Adolescent Health Service is probably my passion project. It's a very difficult environment, so it's at the front end of our health system. It's probably, in my view, the most impactful in terms of ability to make change over time, but the most difficult. I was driven there by a real passion around mental health, particularly around adolescent mental health. So it's confronting, and I think I reflected when I joined on my career to date, and I realised it's been very economic focused, and it's, and I've done some social things before, but this is really at the heart of people's you know, difficulties in life, and it's quite a, takes quite a personal toll, those sorts of roles. So I'm loving it, but it's probably the most challenging of all the things I do.
It's been really lovely talking to you. I admire your passion. I'm amazed at your ability to, as I said at the very outset, to balance and organise and get these things done. I suspect you get up early and go to bed late. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for the opportunity.